From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the spring of 2014 when a man was dying of Parkinson's disease. He was suffering, his quality of life had sharply declined, and he knew that his life was ending. What he did not know was how long it would take for him to die, and he dreaded the idea of dying slowly, painfully, perhaps in a hospital room, in his words, hooked up to machines. That man was John Rehm, husband of longtime public radio talk show host Diane Rehm. Diane has toured the country telling her husband's story and advocating for medical aid in dying. It used to be known more frequently as physician-assisted suicide. Diane Rehm wondered why her husband would have been allowed to die peacefully, on his own terms, in a handful of states, but not where they lived in Maryland. In Maryland, he would have to die on the terms of his disease, and it could take many months. Diane Rehm joined us on Connections early last year to discuss her work in writing and in documentary filmmaking, advocating for change. Medical aid in dying is now legal in 10 states and the District of Columbia. The states include California, Colorado, Hawaii, Montana, Maine, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, Vermont, and Washington State, but not New York. There are movements in every state to adopt medical aid in dying laws, and the New York effort is on a kind of tour this week. Before they bring their message to Rochester tomorrow, we've invited some of their proponents to join us on Connections, explaining their positions and talking through how the proposed laws might work and what we're seeing in other states versus what we are currently with here in New York State. And I want to welcome our guests now. The Reverend Dr. Richard Gilbert is with us, Minister Emeritus for the First Unitarian Church. Reverend Gilbert, welcome back. It's always an honor to have you. In your retirement, I don't know what to call you, what your title is anymore.
I'm not sure either, Evan, but I'm always glad to be here. I'm a retired Unitarian Universalist minister, maybe.
It is wonderful to have you. Thank you for being here. And thank you as well to Corinne Carey, who is Senior New York Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices. Corinne, thank you for making time for the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Scott Baracco is with us, an advocate who lost his wife to cancer. Scott, welcome to the program. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for having me.
In a moment, we'll ask Scott to talk a little bit about his own story. Corinne, can you tell us what Compassion and Choices is and what the mission entails?
Sure. Compassion and Choices is a national nonprofit organization. We work to expand options and empower everyone to chart their own end-of-life journey. We affirm the value of life, but we also accept the inevitability of death. And here in New York, we're leading the effort to improve end-of-life care by improving laws around hospice and palliative care, and also leading the effort to pass a medical aid in dying law in this state.
What's the status on legislation in the state right now?
Well, the bill has been pending for 7 years. We'll be entering the eighth year of our campaign when lawmakers return to Albany in January for the 2023 legislative session. We ended really strong, our campaign, when lawmakers left Albany in June. We had more than 72 bill sponsors signed on in support of this bill, but leadership has not put the bill on a committee agenda since 2016, and we have not seen any movement. So we are touring the state, bringing this fight to every corner of New York State, to lawmakers' backyards, and demanding that be the first order of business that they take up and pass in January.
Reverend Gilbert, sometimes this discourse is framed as one in which people who self-identify as religious, strongly religious, oppose medical aid in dying. They view it as sort of an intervention away from God, et cetera. And, you know, as a longtime minister yourself, can you give me your own perspective and what you see as the discourse that frames it that way?
Yes, there are many different opinions, certainly religiously, on this, as in many issues. But many groups, including my own Unitarian Universalist Association, which passed a resolution supporting death with dignity, medical aid in dying, in 1988. And for us, it's a matter of individual freedom that we believe we should maintain our moral agency at that critical last moment of death. And so I've had lots of experience in the parish with it, and I've had experiences when my father died with the what I call the tyranny of technology, keeping people alive, giving tests, even though no one wants the test or the treatment. And so for us, it's a matter of religious freedom.
So this is a freedom issue. Interesting. And Scott Baracco, you've become an advocate, and I want to give you space to tell our listeners about your own family story here.
Thank you, Evan. My story is very similar to the one that you spoke about at the beginning of the show from Diane. I lost my girlfriend, Kathy Quinn, in 2014. It was 8.5 years ago. She died of tongue cancer. And Kathy was diagnosed 2 years prior to that. And she took the most extreme use of medical technology that she could in order to live a long life. Like the Reverend was mentioning, the what we can do with medicine these days is incredible. She went through a lot of things that a lot of people that we all know go through with cancer. She did chemotherapy. She did radiation. She had several surgeries. She had a laryngectomy. She had a feeding tube. She did all these things with gusto, with the idea that she could live for a very long time, and that's what she wanted to do, and she worked very hard at it, and I supported her every step of the way. But when the cancer came back for a fourth time, and doctors confirmed it had spread all throughout her body, she really had very little time left to live. And at that point, Kathy focused her ambition on what it was going to be like to die. And like the story that you told, she didn't want to be forced to linger somewhere hooked up to machines or she didn't want to be in some foreign facility that meant nothing to her. What was important to her in her dying days was to be doing the things that she loved, trying to check off a modest bucket list, which included, going to the movies with me and then having me explain it to her later because she'd fall asleep. And focusing on what it would be like to actually die. She didn't want to be in pain. She didn't want to be gasping for breath. And the last thing she wanted to do was leave the home that she loved, her pets. She wanted to die on her own terms. And this was at a time before either one of us had ever heard of medical aid in dying. We didn't even know that it existed. Back then, it was available in just 4 states. We didn't know that. Kathy was determined. I'm sure all of us know people that work with a determination and they plan for their own future. And just like she did planning for all of her health concerns throughout her adult life, she decided that she was going to die peacefully. And she shared with me that she wasn't going to wait around that long. And she attempted to die peacefully in her own home by overdosing, but it failed miserably. Kathy and I learned about medical aid in dying the following day in the hospital when she finally came around and explained to the staff what she was attempting to do. And that's when they told us about medical aid in dying and how you could actually have the control, have the autonomy at the end of your life to have a prescription that you can use if you choose. And if you want to die at home peacefully, you can. And if you want to hang on longer, you can, but it's up to you. And learning this was just, blew our minds, and it was like a kick in the gut at the same time because it wasn't available to her. And it just angered us to no end. And we became advocates instantly. And, of course, she died about a month later not having that at her disposal. It was a terrible death. And I haven't stopped carrying the torch. We're going to pass this.
Wow. Yeah, that mixed feeling that you must have had, it was like, it's 2014, and we're in the wrong state, it must have felt like. I mean, I remember that was around the time that Brittany Maynard's story was gaining more, yeah, I think, prevalence. But when you spoke to medical practitioners, did they have sympathy or empathy for you and Kathy, Scott?
They did. Like I said, when she regained consciousness in the hospital the following day, we had lots of staff talk to us, and they explained to us what medical aid in dying was. They questioned her because, initially they thought of her as potentially being suicidal in some way. They listened to us. They listened to what she was doing. And one of the psychiatrists or one of the people, you know, looked her dead in the eye and said, you're a problem solver, aren't you? And Kathy's eyes lit up and nodded. She couldn't talk. She had a laryngectomy. She couldn't talk the last 10 months of her life. She had to write things out, and she was losing motion in her hands. It was very difficult for her to communicate. But her eyes lit up, and she nodded up and down like crazy, the best that she could. And she's a problem solver. This is how she saw. She had a plan for how she wanted her life to end, and she wanted a say in that. And if medical aid in dying had been available, it would have suited her just fine. And it was frustrating to learn that it wasn't there. But we had lots of empathy, but no help.
Scott, when you listen to people who oppose this, what is the most consistent reason that you're told that these laws should not pass?
There's a couple of them. I remember back, 8.5 years ago when I was just getting into this, the big pushback was, well, we don't know, how it's going to happen. How will we do this? How will it work? And there was only 4 states at the time. But like you said, now there's 10 states plus the District of Columbia. We've got lots of information on how to run it, and it's successful everywhere you look. Oregon's been doing it for over 20 years, and we've got all these other states, and it works as intended. So there's really they really can't use that excuse anymore. And then you also mentioned the faithful problems with it, or they just think that it the religious aspect is we should have a natural death. And I'm kind of losing patience for the natural death argument, because it's a very selective argument that they make. If Kathy had had a natural death, she would have died 2 years sooner. She wouldn't have had chemotherapy. That's wholly unnatural. So it was spraying your body with radiation. They wouldn't have cut out part of her tongue and replaced it with muscle from her arm. That was her first surgery. That was how they got rid of the cancer the first time. But when that didn't work, they cut out more of her tongue and they replaced it with muscle from her leg. And then when that didn't work, they cut out more of her tongue and they replaced it from muscle folded up from underneath her chest. And like I said, she also had a laryngectomy. She had a feeding tube. So she went through all sort of unnatural processes to change the, her expiration date. But when it came time when there was nothing left to do, she was stripped of the right of making those same types of decisions on what her quality of life would be at the very end. She wanted the worst thing you could do to Kathy was not give her the opportunity to make a decision or have a say, have a plan. She just loved planning everything from a lunch menu to a vacation. And she was very involved with her health, with the cancer, challenging doctors, trying to turn over, every stone. And to have that autonomy ripped away at the very end, it was pathetic. It really was. And I just can't see why. I don't see any argument against it that holds any water anymore.
Well, can I ask our guests what they hear from lawmakers? I mean, Scott, you've been advocating for the better part of a decade now. You've watched the list of states and jurisdictions that have passed medical aid in dying laws grow to 10, 11 now. New York is not on them. When you talk to lawmakers and you tell Kathy's story, what's generally the reception you get?
Well, I usually get empathy and nodding and not much beyond that. Corinne can probably speak to it better than I can, but it's an object at rest tends to stay at risk, and I've been trying to push him into movement for 8.5 years, and it's frustrating.
Yeah, Corinne, it's interestingly, when you look at the states, the list here, the only, if we were going to do this politically, the only so-called red state on the list of 10 states and plus D.C. is Montana. So that would indicate that if this is a political issue, and these days everything is political, that states that are more blue tend to be more open to such laws. And yet New York is long considered one of the bluer states in the country, and you haven't been able to do it here. What kind of reception do you get, Corinne?
Well, in fact, it's not really a political or partisan issue at all. And that may be surprising to some people, but New York voters, in poll after poll after poll, have shown that they want terminally ill adults to have this option in New York. And those numbers cross party lines, religion. 70% of Catholics want terminally ill people to have this option, race, gender, age. New Yorkers want this. And there is no doubt about that from the polling that we've seen before COVID, during COVID, and after COVID, right? So what is it? I think the biggest problem that we have here is that this is not a priority for anyone until it is. Until you or a loved one are facing down an inevitable death and the suffering that comes with that, it is then and only then that you see this as an essential issue. You ask any New Yorker, and they'll tell you, for the most part, that they would support this bill. But you ask them to give you a list of priorities that they think that the state legislature should address, and this might not be among the top 10. And so our job has been really convincing lawmakers, some of whom, sadly, have had this experience to a greater or lesser degree than Scott has been describing in their own families. And it is those folks who immediately sign on and support this bill. The nurses in the assembly, people who've lost a loved one. But they need to hear from folks like Scott. And that's part of the reason that we're going to every corner of the state and making sure that they do.
We're talking to Corinne Carey, Senior New York Campaign Director for an organization called Compassion and Choices. And part of their focus in states across the country is on legislation known as medical aid in dying, sometimes referred to as dying with dignity, used to be known and not really known anymore as physician-assisted suicide. And we're talking to Reverend Dr. Richard Gilbert, who's with us, a minister emeritus for the First Unitarian Church here in Rochester. Scott Baracco is on the line with us, an advocate who lost his girlfriend Kathy to cancer in 2014. Listeners, if you've got thoughts that you want to share on this, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. I don't mean to entirely minimize opposition to such laws. We still have 40 out of 50 states that don't have death with dignity or medical aid in dying laws. But the polling that Corinne just cited is correct, and it is consistent. I watched polling for years on this subject. We've talked about it a number of times on this program in the last decade, and the polling is overwhelming in favor of this. So I don't seek to minimize opposition or such voices, but my sense is, Corinne, my sense is that for lawmakers, there's so much to do in a legislative session. There's so much to deal with a budget that, to your point, if this has not impacted them personally, they probably hear Scott's story. They probably hear Diane Rehm's story. They hear your accounts and they go, wow, yeah, I'm on board. But then it kind of just kind of gets lost in the shuffle. It doesn't get done. It's not that they don't really agree. It's just not a priority until it hits them, as opposed to fervent opposition, which is a different thing. Is that a fair way of kind of framing it up?
It is, but I also don't want to discount, like you said, the opposition, because one of the things that I'm really committed to is making sure that when this law passes, we don't have communities around New York State that are terrified for their lives, because that, in fact, is what the opposition is doing. The opposition is small. It's an extreme minority, but they're very vocal. And one of the things that they say is that this is a slippery slope and soon we'll be euthanizing people. Well, no law in this country since Oregon passed the first law in 1994 has ever been expanded to encompass people who are not dying, who aren't making their own requests, who aren't self-ingesting the medication. And so, it's really important for people to know that we're dealing with the politics of fear here. And it's not the first time we've seen this in healthcare debates. There are folks that'll scream from the rooftops until this bill passes that our lives are in jeopardy, particularly people who are vulnerable. But it's just not true. The data bears this out. There has never been a prosecution, an investigation. No one's ever lost their license. And in fact, a very small number of people use this. So why are we fighting so hard for it? Because it gives everyone peace of mind in knowing that, you know, should suffering become too great, there's a door to open, there's a way out. And the last thing I'll say is this law is entirely voluntary. If you don't believe in it, if it frightens you, if it runs afoul of your moral code, you don't have to participate. No patient, no doctor, no pharmacist, no hospice worker, no health system have to participate when this bill inevitably passes.
And just a word, an example from Oregon, a minister, a colleague of mine, Judy, moved from Pennsylvania with her minister husband because she had a cancer that started in her appendix and spread, and she was suffering greatly for many months. So they moved to Oregon, and the morning she decided to do two things. One, celebrate her 77th birthday, which she was able to do. Two, she wanted to vote in the 2020 election, but she knew as time went on that she would not make it. But the morning of her death, before the election, she sat down with her family. She wrote letters to friends in Pennsylvania urging them to vote. That was her last morning of life. And then she went into the room with her family around her and had a very dignified death. And a wonderful life and a dignified death. We can't ask for more.
Let me try to engage with some of the concerns that were raised. And I actually want to play a clip of sound. Megan and Miles, this is the shorter clip from when Diane Rehm was on this program. Diane Rehm was describing in her home state of Maryland what the legislation there specifically would call for. So, for example, if you're going to do this, if you're going to do medical aid in dying, I'm sure in a moment you'll hear Corinne maybe describe if there are sort of legal templates for this, and they're all, if the 10 states that have passed this plus DC, if they're pretty similar. But at least in Maryland, questions came up about, well, when does this become legally and medically an option? Can a person, who has a chronic disease but that might not be a terminal disease end up getting this as an option? What about mental health disorders, et cetera? Diane Rehm was explaining a six-month benchmark, essentially deemed to be 6 months or closer to a patient's likely death from a terminal disease. And here's more of what she had to say about how that would work.
People who are dying want to live, but they have no choice. Someone who commits suicide has a choice. So that in the film, a young woman, 37 years old, says, you know, if I had my druthers, I would live until I was 90. But cancer, breast cancer, has spread throughout my body. It's in my bones. I don't want my young child to see me suffer. So I don't have a choice. And that's the big difference. Suicide is a choice. Medical aid in dying is for those who are within 6 months of death who have no choice.
All right, that was Diane Rehm on this program in early 2021. That particular comment sparked a little bit, I wouldn't call it a backlash, but some pushback from listeners who felt like it was oversimplifying, for example, depression, clinical depression, and why people die by suicide. And so what I want to say to that before I send it over to our guests is this. Our listeners helped me think about that a little differently, but I also understand the point that Diane is making. So we could do two things. We could understand that when someone dies by suicide, they may not feel like they have a choice. They may not feel, you know, that there is an option other than what they are doing. this is complex, and medical professionals, mental health professionals would have a lot better way of describing this than I would. But that's some of what we heard from listeners who felt like Diane Rehm kind of minimized the anguish of mental illness that sometimes leads to suicidal ideation. Her main point, though, was if you have a medical diagnosis of a terminal physical disease, in other words, you will not be able to live beyond another 6 months, according to your doctors, whether you try everything in your power to live or not, then you become eligible for medical aid in dying. That's the legislation as written, and that still has not passed in Maryland. So let me ask our guests about this. Corinne, what would you say about this particular issue?
Well, I love Diane Rehm, and I love what she's done, but I tend to agree with your callers. I think we've learned a lot, or at least I have learned a lot over the past 7 years of working on this campaign about suicide, and I would tend to agree that for people struggling with mental health issues, it doesn't feel like a choice to them. But what I do know is that medical aid in dying is absolutely distinct from suicide. And you're right, the Maryland legislation, as well as every other bill and law in this country around medical aid in dying, requires that someone be an adult, mentally capable, with a terminal illness. And in New York, that's defined as an illness that's incurable and irreversible, and having been given a 6 month prognosis, 6 months or less to live. What's different between medical aid in dying and suicide, though, which I think is an important conversation for us to have, is that people who are using medical aid in dying are making a clear and conscious decision with the consultation of their doctor, in most cases, their family and extended family, and their spiritual advisor or their God. This is a conversation that's done in a calm and deliberate way. And people who use medical aid in dying, as Reverend Gilbert described, are often surrounded by friends and family. That's one thing that COVID taught us, that it's very important that people be around and touching you and being able to speak with you. So with medical aid in dying, you're able to orchestrate a kind of end that's consistent with the way that you've lived, surrounding yourself with family, friends, sometimes your minister, sometimes your healthcare providers, with the music that you like, in the setting that you like, celebrating your life. One of our supporters toasted her sister along with all of the family with champagne and told her how much they meant to her. With suicide, people often die alone, in secret from everyone, and in ways that are absolutely horrific, leaving EMS professionals and others to have to literally clean up and experience the trauma of that. With medical aid in dying, you know, families grieve for sure, but that grieving is mixed with gratitude and love and happy memories. With suicide, there are studies that show that there is intergenerational trauma around suicide in a family. And so these two processes could not be more different.
Mm-hmm. But to be clear, though, does the legislation in New York look like the kind of legislation that Diane described? Does it look like that in most states where I think the issue, and we had a caller named John who wanted to ask about this, what are the guardrails for people who may be depressed? What they hear, without maybe digging deep, is a proposal that sounds like, well, if someone's having a bad day, maybe they get prescribed.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to make sure you're totally clear on, Corinne.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So Oregon, as we've said, was the first state to pass a law like this, and it required that someone be an adult, be terminally ill, and be within 6 months of death. No one qualifies for medical aid in dying. And every state since Oregon has adopted the same exact structure for these laws. So in New York, you need to have a terminal illness that is incurable and irreversible.
Okay.
You need to be given a 6 month prognosis, and you need to be mentally capable. And so two doctors need to affirm all of those things. And if either doctor has any doubt about your mental capacity to make a decision like this, they have to refer you to a mental health professional, and no prescription can be written unless and until that professional determines that you're making a clear and conscious decision voluntarily.
So it sounds to me, Corinne, like you may view this issue a little differently on this particular point than Diane Rehm, but the bottom line is, for those who are suffering with mental illness, for those who may be experiencing suicidal ideation, the hope is that for anybody in that category, and that is millions of people, that it is not irreversible, that there can be ways to find a path forward, sometimes through medication, sometimes through therapy, sometimes through other interventions, and that's not viewed in the same light medically, perhaps, as you're literally dying of cancer and there's nothing we can do to stop it. Is that right?
That's right. And okay. I'll say something that may sound a little counterintuitive to your listeners who are concerned about this issue, but there is a certain proportion of suicide in this country that is related to terminal illness. It's people like Scott's girlfriend, Kathy, who in the face of absolutely no choices, resorts to attempting to take their own life.
Yep.
And those suicides, those attempted suicides could be prevented by actually passing a medical aid and dying law, bringing this practice out of the shadows, and allowing people to orchestrate a beautiful and loving and peaceful death for themselves.
Scott, I know your time is tight. I want to give you a chance to offer some final thoughts for listeners before we have to let you go.
Oh, thank you, Evan. I just can't express enough the urgency that's needed for the bill to be passed. And I guess what surprised me the most in this whole process, naive as I was 8.5 years ago, I thought so long as I could get the attention of somebody in charge and let them know this is a good idea, it would happen pretty quickly. It's very sad to me how long that it's taking, because it's too late for Kathy, but it's not too late for millions of other people, whether they use it or not. It's so beneficial. People are suffering in the absence of medical aid and dying. That's the real lesson that I learned with Kathy. The end of her life could have been so much different. And there are people that need it today. We need to pass it right away. It saddens me that over the 8 years, I have met people who were dying, who were advocating for this, and it still didn't come for them. And there's many, many more now. So it's urgent. So if there's listeners that are touched by this, contact your legislator and let them know you want it passed. You want it passed today. That's my agenda.
I appreciate your testimony here, Scott. Thanks for sharing the story of Kathy and your own story and your own advocacy with us. We'll let you go, and what we'll do is we'll come back in just a second. Scott Baracco, thanks for making the time for the program today.
Thank you.
We're going to come back in a moment after this only break with Reverend Dr. Richard Gilbert, Minister Emeritus for the First Unitarian Church. Corinne Carey is on the line with us, the Senior New York Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices. And if you have sent emails to the program, we're going to get a significant amount of listener feedback on the issue of medical aid and dying next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about why we give during the holidays. I'm not just talking about charity. I'm talking about why we give gifts, wrap up presents for family members, what the obligations are, what the limits are, what is sort of fair or unfair or sort of fun and traditional versus stressful, and maybe how to think about it differently. We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'll take John in Brighton, who I know had some concerns that might have just been addressed. But John, I know you had some thoughts about who's eligible and how this happens. And I'll give you the floor now. Go ahead, John.
Well, thank you. Yes, a lot of the questions were just addressed since I've been waiting. But I do have an additional question that I'd like to hear your panel discuss. And that is what they feel about palliative care, in the sense that palliative care apparently can really help someone in end of life, and they're not having to make a decision to have assistance with dying. They're just having palliative care, which I have seen do a lot of good for folks. And so I'd like them to talk a little bit about palliative care and palliative care physicians, what they offer, short of assistance with just dying.
Okay. Corinne, you want to take that?
Sure, and then Reverend Gilbert might want to add, but I will say that one of the biggest misconceptions about this legislation is that it's an either-or, either hospice and palliative care or medical aid in dying, when in fact, what we've seen in states that have authorized this is that medical aid in dying becomes very inextricably linked to the package of care that you can receive while receiving hospice and palliative care. It's part of a comprehensive end-of-life care plan that hospice providers and palliative care providers appreciate. Because for some kinds of cancers, for some kinds of illnesses, even the gold standard, even the best hospice and palliative care can't relieve all suffering. And we know this because we know the accounts from people who have been receiving hospice and palliative care, and Kathy certainly was, Scott's girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Many, many of us have experience there, and it's just simply not enough, and people still die suffering. But we also know this because we have Dr. Timothy Quill, recently retired from practice at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Dr. Bob Milch, who died 2 years ago. He was the founder of Hospice Buffalo. Both of them were our strongest champions in this movement, and Dr. Quill continues to be, because they themselves, in delivering this care, have seen that even their best treatment falls short, and they would appreciate having this additional option in their toolbox. Fully 85% of people who receive medical aid in dying in states where it's authorized are already receiving hospice and palliative care.
Reverend Gilbert?
I like to see this on a continuum, and Tim Quill has put it very well, of palliative care, hospice, and end-of-life planning is all a part of this, with medical aid in dying at the end of the extreme, at the end of the continuum. I'm 86 years old, and I hope to go on for a good long time yet, but I like to think that I have some choices, and this whole continuum of palliative care, hospice, and then medical aid in dying provides me with an array of choices that I like to have in my back pocket as I begin to face the end of my days. So for me, it's a matter of choice.
Let me get some more feedback from listeners. This is from Sandy. She says, my mother died in February of this year from the physical effects of dementia. As her healthcare proxy, I had many discussions with her before her cognitive issues set in. Loud and clear, my mom voiced her interest in, support of, and personal desire for the ability to choose to die should she be stricken with any sort of terminal illness. Her benchmark was this: when I don't know my children anymore. We went so far past that line in the sand. Her end was physically horrifying for her and emotionally devastating for us, her children. Medical dying should absolutely be the right of every human being on the planet. I think that the problem with passing legislation may be how to identify which conditions would be covered. Terminal illnesses would be a given. Diagnosed dementia should be considered a terminal illness. That is from Sandy. Thank you, Sandy. Corinne, you want to respond to that real briefly before I jump back to some others?
Sure. I'll just say that we've got so many issues to address in end-of-life care. And what's really important to keep in mind about medical aid in dying is that it is for decisionally competent people. No one can make this request for you. A healthcare proxy can't say that they know that this is something that someone would have wanted. It has to be a contemporaneous request. That said, Compassion and Choices has done a lot of work in this area, and for folks concerned about a dementia or Alzheimer's diagnosis, there is advanced care planning that you can do to make sure that you receive no treatment for an infection, for example, or for other illnesses while you're experiencing dementia that might be able to alleviate some of that end-of-life suffering that the caller reported. And I am so sorry that her mother died in that way. There are things that can be done. It's just, unfortunately, not medical aid in dying.
Roger writes to say, it's pretty sad that our government almost requires the medical profession to torture a dying person into their ultimate death. It was horrible to see my dad hooked up to many wires and hoses in order to prolong his life. He wanted none of it. He wasn't afraid to die, but he didn't want to suffer. Thank you for this discussion. That is from Roger. Kathy says, it has been my experience that most people opposed to this, opposed to certain medical procedures, whether it's abortion, vaccines, or medical aid in dying, are not the people that have spent any time in an ICU unit caring for people. That's a thought from Kathy. Jane says, one thing I don't understand is why doctors are seemingly okay with the physical pain that those with terminal illnesses are in, but veterinarians will tell you to put an animal down. In certain ways, it seems as though pain that humans are in is acceptable, but you should never allow it for animals. I'm not articulating my thoughts here properly, and I apologize, but there's a disparity in the way we can treat our animals, but not human beings. I will never forget my grandfather, who had a slow, agonizing final few years, saying, I wish it was like this with horses, where they shoot you and you're free from this. That is from Jane. I mean, she freely admits, I mean, that's a clumsy, kind of a horrible way to think about it, but that's where her grandfather was. I don't know. I mean, Reverend Gilbert, what do you make of that, that kind of distinction that she's making between human beings and the way we think about animals and their deaths?
They shoot horses, don't they? Yeah, that is haunting to me. I think of one doctor, I can't think of his name, from Fairport, who was attending a patient of his in a nursing home. He worked out an arrangement with this man to give him extra medication for him to die. This is without legal authority, of course, but a nurse spotted it. He was called up for a grand jury, and this doctor was so crushed by the thought that he would be prosecuted for helping a friend of his, a patient of his, die, he committed suicide in his garage. Now, that's just one story of the fear of the medical profession that they will be harmed, brought before juries and so forth. So Tim Quill was brought before a grand jury, as I recall, and the case was dismissed. But doctors are fearful because there are zealots who will prosecute them or persecute them for what they do.
Corinne Gale writes to say, does Montana support this based on more people in that state working with animals who can be euthanized when they are suffering? It seems odd to me that we allow animals to be humanely die, but not people. So that's another sort of question similar. That's from Gale asking, is that the reason a so-called red state passed this? More sort of experience with death up close. I don't know.
I was wondering if that might be a libertarian.
Yeah, I kind of wondered that too.
Because Montana is a very red state, but libertarian. And libertarians may go for the choice that we have at the end of life.
But not New Hampshire. But it's interesting. Corinne, any thoughts on that?
Well, I do want to clarify that Montana's legislature never passed this. Medical aid in dying is legal in Montana because of a court decision. But Montana follows the same exact processes for medical aid in dying, even though it's not legislatively prescribed, as every other state. So I don't disagree. I think there's a libertarian streak. I think there are naturalists and people who work with animals in Montana, and that may be why there's not been tremendous opposition there. But to be clear, it was legalized through a court decision.
I want to read another piece of opposition, and I want to quote from an article from 2018 from the Altamont Enterprise, and they're talking about folks from the Center for Disability Rights. And, of course, we've talked to Stephanie Woodward on this program a number of times, and Stephanie's quoted in the piece. This is, again, from 4 years ago. I'll read from the piece now. Stephanie Woodward, Director of Advocacy at the Center for Disability Rights, said that, quote, assisted suicide has a discriminatory, disparate impact on disabled people that is deadly and can't be reversed, end quote. Data from the state of Oregon, where medical aid in dying has been allowed for over two decades, according to Woodward, shows that the top five reasons people choose assisted suicide have nothing to do with pain, but instead have to do with disabling conditions, like feeling like a burden to my family, or feeling like you have a loss of autonomy or independence, or even loss of bladder or bodily function control. Actually, in the data, these responses do not fall under a heading of reasons for wanting to die, but under end-of-life concerns. Woodward said, quote, these are all disabling conditions that people with disabilities face every single day, and we don't believe that they should be a basis for wanting to die. end quote. And goes on to say that if our health care does not provide the services and support people need to live, then we cannot create an option to die and call it an option, end quote. Corinne Carey, what would you say to that?
Oh, I would say so much. I mean, we have so much work to do in terms of respecting and fully integrating people living with disabilities into all of our systems in the society and in the medical community, most of all. But it is fundamentally different to stare down your inevitable death with the continuing loss of function than it is to live with certain limiting conditions. And I will say that the data that Stephanie Woodward quoted from Oregon, that's data that is reported by doctors, not by patients themselves. And it is there are many factors that people cite for wanting to use medical aid in dying. Reverend Gilbert talked about, and both Scott and Reverend Gilbert talked about people who want to control and have options. But you can't deny when you've talked to, as I have, hundreds of families and people who are terminally ill in New York, it is pain and it is suffering that they fear. So, yep, there's data from Oregon that is reported by physicians, not by patients and their families themselves. And that data was collected where people could check a number of different things that were of concern to them at the end of their lives. So, yes, these are things that are of concern to people at the end of their lives. But most of all, people want autonomy and they want to avoid needless suffering. And these arguments and lawmakers believing these arguments from the opponents just mean that New Yorkers every year die suffering. We've lost 22 advocates. And I could tell you the stories of their pain and their suffering at the end of life because lawmakers have failed to act. So I'm happy to look at the data from Oregon. We do all the time. It's important. And the Disability Rights Organization in Oregon agreed with Stephanie on one point that, you know, the only complaints that they ever received about the Oregon law were that the safeguards were too strict for some members of the disability community to participate and access medical aid in dying. So that's what the data from Oregon is showing us, is that none of the fears that opponents have claimed would happen with a medical aid in dying law have ever come to pass.
I think part of her concern is that we need better healthcare in general, especially for the disability community, and people shouldn't be scared to transition. We hear all the time, we talk about the disability community as if it's fixed, as opposed to the fact that any person anywhere could find themselves among the disability community for any number of reasons. And I think part of what Stephanie is saying, and I would never want to speak for her, is that, you know, we certainly need better healthcare in general. People should not fear becoming a member of that community for no matter how much time. And I understand that point, Corinne, I think.
Oh, without a doubt. In fact, people living with disabilities have been on the front lines of our fight for more equitable and better and affordable health care for people. And so it's concerning to me that there are some members in the disability rights community that are afraid of this bill, and they ought not be. We believe in autonomy. They've been fighting for autonomy for decades. And there is no doubt that we need to improve the healthcare system for all of us, but particularly for people living with disabilities. And those folks have been on the front lines for all of us.
In our last minute, Reverend Gilbert, I think about one of the cases that ended up being a national story with this that became, I mean, we still know that when you mention the name Terri Schiavo, which is almost two decades old now, people remember this battle that was going on about a person who could not speak for herself, and certain advocates for her saying, you know, she was on the brink of recovery. And we certainly found out medically after she passed was that she was not. But it was mostly people from the religious community saying, you cannot give up on this recovery. This is, you know, and the emotion that stirs was so powerful. It kind of was this cleaving of the country along this. Do you see common ground on this, or do you think certain issues are kind of intractable?
Well, I recall during that case, a couple of United States senators who happened to be doctors were given a video connection with her, and they, from a distance, pronounced her healthy enough to live on. But their perspective was clearly anti-medical aid in dying. So I think there are so few cases like that. Every case is different. We can't make it simple. We can't make it simple. But the common ground, I think, is freedom to choose. I think everyone must agree that we ought to have the freedom to decide what we do in life and how we face our death. And that is the common ground, I think, we would find if we would just sit down and talk about it.
Corinne, as we close here, where would you want people to go to learn more about what you're trying to do?
Yeah, folks can find us on the web at compassionandchoices.org. You can navigate there with a /New York, or you could search for the New York campaign on our website. You can also find us on Facebook. We generally post all of our activities on New York, Compassion and Choices New York's Facebook page.
And we'll be at 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at the First Unitarian Church, and Corinne will be there.
Corinne Carey, Senior New York Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices, thanks for joining the program today. Keep us updated.
Thank you so much for having us.
And our thanks to Reverend Dr. Richard Gilbert, Minister Emeritus for First Unitarian Church. Always nice to have you. Thank you for being
here. Thanks. Nice to be here, Evan.
More connections coming up in just a moment.